You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 5th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, MSNBC correspondent Joy Reid and author of Fracture. Also on the program today, the TPP drops. The text is now released, ladies and gentlemen. I think it was released by the New Zealand government, I presume with the awareness of the American government. Unclear if that means that the clock begins to tick on when a vote must be taken in the House and the Senate. This date and timeline, obviously very important because it addresses the question as to whether or not it's going to get caught up in the, particularly the Republican presidential campaign. Also on the program today, Poppy Bush. It was all Dick Cheney's fault. My son had nothing to do with it. And of course, you can't blame Jeb if my first son had nothing to do with it, which is not why I'm dropping this book now with that. Also on the program today, Jeb Bush walking on hot coals in New Hampshire. Ben Carson. Is he a fraud? Well, that remains to be seen, but we do know this. He has figured out what those silly pyramids in Egypt were all about.
I also have some thoughts on the White Album and some other things as well.
We will get to that, of course, later in the program. TransCanada asking the Obama administration to put a pause on their deliberations on Keystone XL, and the Obama administration says no. And when is $11 billion not so much money? All that and more on today's program, plus some very good news, perhaps, about the Republican debates. I don't know if it's really good news from the perspective of the Republican debates, because I think he made it slightly more entertaining. But from my perspective, I'm pretty excited at the prospect that Chris Christie may not make it into the big boy debates. So he will have his own platform in the little boy debates, which will be good. Folks, just a reminder. Harry's is the official partner of Movember. The Movember Foundation. Lawyer Matthew IM'd us the other day, says he does it every year. I was wondering what that was about. Every year he grows a mustache. And apparently this is Movember is about donating money and helping raise awareness for men's health. Yeah, I guess what you do is you grow a mustache in support of it. I won't be doing that.
You want to do it? I will do it for one day this month if you do it.
No. I won't do it. I mean, I'll do it for one day. I'll go one day without shaving. I go one day without shaving.
No, I meant
all the time.
Mustache specifically, as in you grow out the beard, shave everything else, and have a mustache for one
day. Oh, well, I can't do that. Sorry. I've got to be well shaven. And frankly, the fact that I need to be well shaven is exactly why I am so pleased to talk about Harry's. Harry's.com, as you know, was started by two guys who are passionate about creating a better shaving experience. And I got to say, I was always skeptical about the idea of a shaving experience. I mean, you shave. But nevertheless, it really is. I mean, I guess it's an experience. It really is better. And Harry's starter set is an amazing deal. With my code Majority Report, if you've never gone to harrys.com before and purchased a starter set, you can get it for $10. They also give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time back to the communities they serve at Harry's. You get a razor handle, 3 blade cartridges, and either the shaving cream or the shaving lotion or the foaming lotion or the just the cream for $15. But if it's your first time, you get $5 off of that by using the coupon code Majority Report. That's harrys.com. HARRYS.com. Enter the code Majority Report. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as you may or may not be aware, Donald Trump will be on SNL this weekend. And if you are going to the live taping of SNL this weekend, you have an opportunity to make $5,000. What? How would you do that? Apparently, the Deport Racism PAC, which is a Latino advocacy group, it's offering $5,000 to any audience member who calls Donald Trump a racist on air. This is awesome. This is totally awesome. First off, this is why people like live TV, is because stuff like this could actually happen. I mean, it's going to be why I tune into the SNL for the first time in probably 25 years. That's a bit of an exaggeration. But honestly, I'm going to tune in. I don't really care about Donald and find him, you know, entertaining, except for in the context of he is the front runner of the Republican Party. But as a host on SNL, I could care less. But I am going to enjoy it when at least one person says, I can make $5,000 by calling this racist a racist on air. I'll do it. And it's going to be fascinating to see how how they try and stop this. So $5,000, they're looking either for an audience member or maybe an employee or somebody like that to just yell out, you're a racist, during the taping of SNL and the live broadcast of it. So that could make it interesting. I imagine everybody involved in this is going to appreciate this on some level, except for Trump. And I will say this, when somebody does yell that out, and it's hard to believe that nobody will, I mean, we may not hear it because, you know, you can't project that far into the mics, but we'll see. Donald Trump's Republican standing will go up 2 percentage points.
Right.
That's my prediction. He had 2% bump for being called a racist
man,
on TV.
He must really get it.
Oh, man. It's a typical New York, forgive my French, Jew situation.
You know, I always thought Donald Trump was kind of lying about it. But when they have to go at him like that, maybe he's really speaking the truth, man.
We need to come to his defense. Today's show, ladies and gentlemen, what is that?
He'll have the face that he will give when that happens. The guy does not exactly. You got it. If you're seeing this on YouTube, the lower lip puckered out.
The real question is, if he hears it, does he respond and say, "Latino people love me"? In fact, I'm standing next to a Latino person.
You're describing the best SNL since Eddie Murphy. If that happens.
Folks, today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm. It's a brand new app and website that changes the way you think about podcasts. With Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to dozens of original miniseries, audio documentaries, and comedy albums, all the archives from WTF with Marc Maron, all the Earwolf shows like Comedy Bang Bang or How Did This Get Made? One of the original shows. Oh, wow. Well, I'm not a big fan of necessarily that show, but there are some really good, unique shows. The Jerry Minor one that we were talking about the other day.
Jerry Minor show looks really cool.
And the one about those sort of lost artists. There's a couple. Go check it out. Definitely worth checking out. You get access to all this exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, and your web for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code MAJORITY, you get a full month of free trial. To redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account at the web at howl.fm. Enter the code MAJORITY at checkout. Go. You get a free month. Why not? You cancel afterwards if you don't like it. If you do, it's $5. So go to howl.fm. That's howl, as in H-O-W-L, .fm. Use the promo code MAJORITY. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Joy Reid about her new book, Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide. We are back on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the Majority Report Joanne Reid. She is a national correspondent for MSNBC and author of the newly released Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide. Joy, welcome to the program.
Sam, it is great to be on. Thank you.
So, all right. Now, obviously, an incredibly timely book, and particularly with what we saw over the course of the summer with Black Lives Matter, and in many ways, the Democratic candidates, I think, paying more attention to at least this very specific issue of the way that black people are policed in this country, but probably also more broadly the questions of race, because I have a feeling that the Democratic presidential candidates wanted to get away from race to a certain extent, following up after President Obama's term, but even today Bernie Sanders, I think it was, in an interview said, conceded in, I don't know if conceded is the right word. I mean, it's rather obvious. He said, if the election was held today and only amongst African Americans, I'd lose. And frankly, it wouldn't even necessarily have to be only amongst African Americans. African Americans for the Democratic Party, a hugely crucial and massive constituency. So with all that said, well, let's just start with the idea of fracture. I mean, where is the fracture, and is it, in many respects from your book, it's describing a dynamic that's actually taken place, and you track it since from LBJ, but why don't you tell us?
Well, Sam, it's interesting that you starting with the Democrats now, yes, they are addressing Black Lives Matter, but it really was not something they did proactively. So it's interesting how it kind of reinforces the theme that I've tracked when I started doing the research for this book back in 2013, that I've tracked back 50 years, which is that the Democratic Party needs African Americans, but doesn't necessarily prioritize African Americans unless really forced to, which is what happened in the 1960s, which is that the Civil Rights Movement, made a demand, which is that the place where most black Americans live, the South, was locking them out of the only avenue to political power, which was the Democratic Party. There was a functioning Republican Party south of the Mason-Dixon line. And so, you know, African Americans essentially had to break into the Democratic Party in order to exercise any political power at all. And so you saw this phenomenon where a Southern Democrat like Lyndon Johnson really defied both his racial caste and his political party by championing and pushing through voting rights reform at the insistence of the civil rights movement, and he did it in a way that even Kennedy was had been reluctant to do. So this creates this revolution in the party that then goes from being the party of segregation to being the party that 50 years later could produce Barack Obama. But what's interesting to me, Sam, is that now you fast forward to 2015, and it took protests to get a party that had three white nominees, two over 60, to pay attention to this very constituency. It still took a demand and insistence for these candidates to say, oh, wait a minute, we have to pay attention to Black Lives Matter, because they didn't do it practically.
Right. And certainly they were sort of dragged kicking and screaming, maybe a slight exaggeration, but not dramatically. I mean, they literally could not avoid dealing with it. And it's also sort of, I guess, surprising too, because on some level the Black community is, I mean maybe there's a slight overstatement, but I don't think so, is in many ways sort of the one of the primary deciding factors, I think, in to the extent that that Bernie Sanders can really mount a successful challenge to Hillary Clinton. It's going to be a function of the African American community, and that's really, and I think he's aware of that. That's where it's going to pivot on. But let's go back here too. I mean, so when we talk about this change that LBJ basically created in terms of the relationship to Blacks in the Democratic Party at this point, when we go further, the unwinding of those gains almost begins immediately, doesn't it?
Yeah, it begins literally immediately, because what happens is that you have the Civil Rights Act, which was going to be the Civil Rights Act of 63, but of course Kennedy is assassinated after his administration introduces the bill. Johnson pushes it through. He signs it in July. 2 days after he signs, Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 64, the three civil rights workers, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, disappear in Mississippi. 2 days later, after the Senate votes on the bill. And then their bodies are found in August, just a month after the signing, after the bill is completed. The bill is completed in July. Their bodies are found in August. And then 20 days after their bodies are found, you have the Democratic Convention open, and literally this is 2 months now in total after Lyndon Johnson's seminal achievement getting the Civil Rights Bill through, done, and signed. The Johnson administration is already rejecting the Mississippi Freedom Democrats' pretty, I think, obvious demand that they be allowed to participate in the Democratic Party of Mississippi. The white-run Democratic Party of Mississippi was still not allowing any African-Americans to participate in the election, and so the Mississippi Freedom Democrats, which is composed of a lot of members of SNCC, they form their own. They do their own multiracial, multi-ethnic slate, and they try to get that slate seated. And it's Lyndon Johnson, the same guy, is saying, please get these people off TV. I don't want them on my television, and they need to stop disrupting my election, because he now needs to get elected in his own right, because he'd taken on the presidency because of Kennedy's assassination. So you have this happen right away. And this push-pull between Democrats and African-Americans continues for 50 years. So that you have, by 1984, when Jesse Jackson mounts this real movement, it's, you know, we talk about the Bernie Sanders movement, the Jackson run had the same vibe. It was this movement going across the South where not just African-Americans, but ultimately liberals caught on to it by 88, white liberals and African-Americans, and he's running as this explicit liberal, but he gets slapped down by the party that says, okay, that's great, thank you for registering these voters, now please sit down and be quiet. And so this happens over and over and over again until you have Bill Clinton do the ultimate Jesse Jackson diss of not just him but of Sister Soldier in 92, because the Democrats had a conundrum, which is that they were the party of Southern white voters and Northern white voters. But then when they became the party of Northern white liberals and African Americans, it made it harder to win in the white suburbs, quite frankly. And Democrats have been trying to figure out how to hold on to white suburban voters ever since. And that's been their big puzzle, is how do we keep African Americans, keep white liberals, and also get back the erosion of white suburban voters. And that's been always what they've been trying to do.
All right. Well, let's talk. I mean, you know, on it's interesting, too, because, I mean, we've had a couple of interviews over the past couple of months about the sort of the racism that was baked into the New Deal policies as a trade-off to those Southern Democrats. And ones that still have had implications 70 years later on these things in terms of home health care workers and whatnot. But moving forward, how do we, like, when you look at the relationship between the Democratic Party and Jesse Jackson, how do we parse out, and then sort of I don't know if the backlash is the right word with Bill Clinton. How do we parse out how much of this is a function of race and how much of it is a function of liberal policies? And then I guess a subset question of that is there in some respects or at least at that time, I mean, was there a difference? I mean, because there's and I want to move into this in a bit, but there's an argument that in many ways Barack Obama muted what was, prior to Barack Obama's ascension, some of the most progressive and radical voices within the left. But before we get to that, I mean, how do you parse that stuff out when you look at Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88?
Well, I mean, I think Jesse Jackson was the culmination of, I mean, his first sort of big speech in terms of the demands of black voters was really in 72 during this big convention in Gary where African-American leaders from all around the country got together to decide, okay, what's going to be our agenda now that you've had all of this civil rights legislation passed, but it was already being rolled back because of Vietnam. All the spending went to the war and away from the war on poverty, away from the Great Society. But what wound up happening is their whole plan gets upended because Shirley Chisholm decides to run, and that they weren't expecting that. But Jesse Jackson stands up and makes these demands that we need to have in the black community a black agenda, quite, you know, simply. He then runs on that in 84 and 88, but he then adds by 88 this liberal agenda. He was talking about things nobody was talking about, Palestine, things that were completely taboo, raising the minimum wage, a lot of what we're fighting about now, the idea of fair wages, really running as an explicit open liberal. So he was kind of both. To the point where the nation actually endorses him in 88 and says he's a legitimate candidate. So I think part of it, the race part of it, is that Democrats just look at the math and they understand that they need African-American voters who are not just loyal to the party in large part because this is the party that does the policies they like, but that are also concentrated in big cities and big states. So African-Americans are not just important, they're important in states where it's important, in Ohio, in places like increasingly North Carolina is becoming a potentially purple state. So black voters are concentrated, too, and they're in big cities, which is why Democrats have such an advantage in the Electoral College. So they have to cater to black voters, right? So Barack Obama feels a need that Democrats have to cater to African-Americans. But Democrats really just pragmatically also still need to not completely lose the white vote. They just can't fathom that they can win as a national party with almost no white voters. And Democrats lose the white vote every time. Every Democratic presidential candidate loses the white vote. They get in the 40s.
Right.
So it's just this mathematical puzzle. Now, for Democrats, the advantage is at least Democrats' math is multicultural, which is what the country is. The Republicans' math is a completely different problem. They've inherited all the white Southerners that used to be Democrats. They've got them. They've inherited all the white rural voters who used to be Democrats. They've got them. But they've got almost nobody else. They are almost entirely white party. So Democrats have a natural advantage being multiracial. Ask this question of the more they cater to black voters, the more it turns off white voters. It's just, unfortunately, a fact of life. When Barack Obama says something that black people like, when he talks about Trayvon Martin, white voters plummet in terms of the approval of him every single time. So it is just a freaking conundrum.
Your phone's breaking up just a little bit, Joy. And if it continues, maybe we'll just call you back on your cell. But I'm trying to get at is that I mean there's two different sort of issues at play, or I should say sort of issue sets at play, right? And one is you've got by 88 you have Jesse Jackson talking about a rainbow coalition, right? As opposed to talking about as opposed to identifying it as a something programmatic. Okay, I mean he's talking about the coalition in terms of we have an umbrella where different people come in, but presumably, right? There's similar interests, and so. It's not the Justice for All coalition. It's the Rainbow Coalition. And so, you know, when we talk about President Obama responding to Trayvon Martin, well, there's also the issue of like, you know, what has happened in terms of policies that may, you know, impact the black community more. For instance, the mortgage crisis, right, where you had black Americans losing a far greater amount of wealth in the crash of 2008 than white America, and the foreclosure loss greater amongst African Americans. Yet, and so the policies he pursues in response to that are not necessarily sort of targeted at. Making black Americans more disadvantaged, but are necessarily so because they're suffering from that calamity even more, right? And so it's distinct on some level from how he responds as a black man to Trayvon Martin in terms of policies. Where's that fracture?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, for a lot of black intellectuals, what you just described is the big problem they have with Barack Obama, which is that his programmatic responses to issues where black Americans are disproportionately disadvantaged is always to go to the program and stay away from the racial component and just not mention it and not target, even though, to your point, even the New Deal was explicitly broken down to disadvantage African Americans. The FHA system of buying homes was explicitly written to advantage white Americans over black Americans. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written volumes, right, about the fact that these things weren't incidental. They were actually written in to ensure that white GIs could come home from World War II and get a home and go to college, but black GIs were just left out of it. Or even specific union advances in which unions openly discriminated against African Americans. They didn't want them in the unions.
Right.
So when you have policies that historically have been explicitly racial, it bothers a lot of black folk that the president refuses to go there when he talks about policy to fix it. Whereas he will go there on immigration for Latinos, even though immigration is not just a Latino issue, but he'll couch it in very explicit terms for Latino Americans or for LGBT Americans. He'll be very explicit. So I think that has been a source of fissure between the president and black people, quite frankly. But the reality is the other party is tonally so negative and seems so hostile in a lot of ways that African Americans stay in the Democratic Party for practical reasons. And so what you're talking about is really a fight that's happening between Democrats now, where you have Bernie Sanders going after economic issues but not really tying them to race and therefore not being able to grow his numbers with black people. And you have Hillary Clinton, who's really putting her pedal to the metal. I just interviewed one of the moms of a victim of police violence who met with Hillary Clinton, and she went out of her way to meet with mothers who've lost children either at the hands of police or just street violence. So she's trying to really put her foot on the gas when it comes to talking to black people. So it's just it's a weird thing that's taking place now inside the Democratic Party. And other than Rand Paul, Republicans are just not taking part.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, at least in the context of this audience, I mean, the dynamic that I think we all understand that there's nothing happening in terms of the Republican Party for anybody but a rather narrow subset of Americans. But in the context of what you're writing about, I'm just curious because on some level, look, you know, Bill Clinton sort of in some respects did the same thing that Barack Obama did. Right. And now I understand, you know, from the perspective of Barack Obama, there is this this notion that he is more in some way constrained because or perceives himself to be more constrained because he's black and because he doesn't want to be perceived as being a black president as opposed to an American president. And the notion that, you know, Randall Kennedy writes about in his book, The Persistence of the Color Line, that in some ways this had, you know, whether perceived or real, and it's probably real, that the president cannot address these things without some type of pushback. But we still saw the same dynamic in many respects with Clinton, with Bill Clinton, didn't we? I mean, because this is a guy who was ostensibly the first black president. He certainly felt like he was, and yet pursued policies that ultimately were extremely disadvantageous to black people. I mean, also, I think across the spectrum, you know, people living arguably in the middle class and the working class and poor. But ultimately, you know, things like Glass-Steagall, right? I mean, this stuff ends up disadvantaging black people. And there's also, I think, an element of Bill Clinton starting, you know, sort of the similarities between Obama and Bill Clinton in terms of the way that they address the black community, it seems to me, are far greater than one would sort of intuitively imagine.
Yeah, no, they're very similar. What I find fascinating is that Bill Clinton, so on the respectability politics side of it, you know, I was reading through speeches that Bill Clinton gave in the 90s that were exactly what Barack Obama says and takes a lot of heat for from black people because he's doing this pull up your pants, turn off the TV. Bill Clinton does the exact same thing. These two are so similar that the fact that they couldn't come together was kind of ironic, right? Because they really are similar in terms of policy and the way they address African Americans. Of course, the big difference is Bill Clinton is far more likely to emote on race than Barack Obama is. And he's more likely to be frank, as is Hillary Clinton, to be honest. When they talk about race, they're a lot more blunt than Barack Obama is. They have a freedom he doesn't have, and they speak with a freedom that he doesn't appear to have. I think he has it now, because now he's right now he's Luther. Like, he's changed. Like, now that he's in his last 18 months, Barack Obama's, like, really loose, and now he's saying things he didn't say before. But, yeah, you definitely had a lot of similarities. And for Bill Clinton, you have to understand, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton was trying to pull off this enormous feat of keeping African Americans in the fold, and his style made African Americans feel welcome. His affect made African Americans feel welcome. And he was also, at the same time, pulling back in white Reagan Democrats by being tough on crime, by being the guy that goes in and sends 100,000 cops into the inner city, by being the guy who does welfare reform before Newt Gingrich can do an even worse version of it, which he had planned. So he pulls this off, and he gets reelected because he pulled it off, and he still retains the love of African Americans because he pulls it off. And I think it's a testament to what a good politician Bill Clinton is, quite frankly. He only stops being able to pull it off in 2008 when his rhetoric, which is, you know, out of practice in terms of politics, and was just, he tried to, and was expressing, I think, that they're hurt at suddenly turning off black people and having competition for black love, quite frankly. It was only in 08 that he stopped being able to do it.
I mean, this is this dynamic, you know, this sort of, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, this is a sort of the classic Clinton triangulation. And in some ways, it also is indicative of, like, the broader relationship between black people, and I'm not saying this doesn't also apply to maybe other subsets of Democrats, but black people to the Democrats, which is, you know, like you say, and we're hearing this from Hillary Clinton in the context of DOMA as well, that, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, he gets to welfare reform. He is heading off something worse. So I did something bad to head off something worse. And that's essentially sort of the triangulation, right? And it's the idea is that, like, you got really nowhere else to go. Right. It's either my way or their way, and their way is going to be worse. And that's sort of the dynamic that the Democrats have with African Americans, and at some level is also the dynamic they have with, sort of more generically speaking, the left.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, there's a saying that Democrats hate their base, Republicans fear theirs. And I think in a lot of ways, that's kind of true. And you had liberals, you know, if you think Jesse Jackson was set aside in the 80s, what about the liberal wing of the party, which was just disinvited from the party? The McGovern, Mario Cuomo wing of the party was essentially written off by the new Democrats in a way that African Americans weren't, because they still needed African Americans. But yeah, there's been this sense of, you know, the way to make this pivot was to push liberals outside of the circle of trust. And that is what happened. The irony is that with all that you talk about, where the Clinton said we had to do this bad thing to prevent that worse thing that Newt Gingrich was going to do on LGBT issues, with DOMA, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on the crime bill, which, by the way, the crime bill was also supported by a lot of black people because there was literal war going on in the streets of some inner cities because of the drug trade, because of illegal, you know, drugs being illegal. All that ended when Barack Obama came in, because the left essentially said, we're not having that triangulation anymore. And I think a lot of the fracture, if you will, between liberals and African Americans was the extent to which white liberals declared, only when Obama got there, once Obama got there, we're not letting you triangulate, and we're going to be as hard on you as we would be on a Republican. And you had liberals withdraw, in a lot of ways, their support from Barack Obama in his first 2 years in a way that stunned African Americans, and which created a rift between blacks and liberals that I think you still see playing out with Bernie Sanders supporters and black people. The kind of hostility that you see between a lot of feel the burn people and a lot of African Americans is of a piece with what I saw in 2009, 2010, when black Americans were saying, wait a minute, you on the left, white liberals, never held Bill Clinton to account as he was actively triangulating against you, more than he was doing against us. But now that the black guy's here, you're ready to fight him. And the irony is that fight was successful. Barack Obama has been pushed to the left farther than I'm sure he intended to go on gay rights, on immigration. It's only African Americans that have not been able to push him into explicit racial policy. But liberals have been very successful. They now are the voice of the party. It's Bernie pushing Hillary to the left of where she ever thought she'd go. So liberals have sort of won the argument in the Democratic side. But they haven't necessarily created more friendly relationships with black people.
I mean, do you think, I'm curious, because that perception I think to a certain extent, liberals were tougher on Barack Obama. I think I seem to remember when Clinton won, there was a decent amount of disaffection by liberals. I mean, I'm quite convinced that without the talk of impeachment, in many respects, that Bill Clinton would have been in much bigger trouble, frankly, because I think there was a lot of people who were coming to aid him because really a function of things like the impeachment. I mean, let's remember, you know, just look at the development of Move On, right? I mean, Move On starts as a response explicitly, I mean, literally meant move on from impeachment, move on and start taking care of the country's business, right? But over time, this group moves into becoming a more explicitly liberal organization. So it was really and frankly, I mean, I've seen this dynamic play out over the past month with Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. You know, the Republicans have this sort of like literally psychotic need to go after the Clintons in a way that they don't go after anywhere else. And so we see a response on the left of the Democratic Party, or the Democratic Party broadly speaking, and I would say some on the left fall, sort of enter into this mode where it's like, we've got to, you know, this is incredible overreach. And you see Hillary's numbers go up as she's being attacked by Republicans. In my sense, that's a big part of the story with Bill Clinton. Not that there was something particularly that liberals found it easier to attack President Obama. Now, with that said, the expectations were higher, right? Because you had just gone through 8 years of George Bush, and frankly, there was some, you know, issues that President Obama spoke very forcefully about that very quickly he reversed on. I mean, the one I'm thinking about is the bankruptcy bill, right? That took place that summer. I mean, that was the first time you started to hear, and I remember this clearly, where many of us on the liberal left of the party were like, this is problematic. You know, we'll give him a pass on Rahm Emanuel, but this bankruptcy thing was the first sort of height of it. And I remember, I think it was Bill Maher was complaining about liberals crying about that. And that's where it started. But you, from your perspective, African-Americans felt on some level that he was being maligned because he was the first African-American president.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about the bankruptcy bill, because I wish I'd been able to write about it more, but, you know, you have a limited amount. Your editor starts saying you have to start cutting things. But one of the things I really actually did a lot of kind of research on was that bankruptcy bill and the extent to which the civil rights community, black and white, went after the White House, because there were a lot of promises made in the campaign season by Obama World that they were going to do cram down, which your listeners probably know, understand it. But, you know, for any who don't remember it, this was the idea that banks were running up the totals on people whose homes were no longer worth $200,000, but they owed $400,000, and the banks wanted every penny. And even though the banks had done some of these mortgages completely unethically, they still wanted their $400,000. And there was this real belief among the civil rights community that the president was going to do cram down.
Well, I mean, he said he was, right? I mean, he said that in 2008, in 2000, as this was being debated. I mean, he said he was going to support a cram down, right?
That's right. And then it didn't happen. And there were these tense meetings that took place with the then candidate, with the then president-elect, and civil rights leaders, in which they went at him and said, this is something, and I'm talking about African-American civil rights leaders, were saying, you were going to do this, and they were already signaling before they even took office that they were going to back down on it. And between that and, if you'll remember, you know, the president had run, the then candidate had run on the public option and on disbelieving the idea that health care would even be valid without the public option. I can remember that. I was blogging at the time and was writing that, you know, about this ethical question of whether you had to have a version of the commons if you were going to have health care reform. And one of the deals that was made to bring him the Clinton side on board was to relax on that issue and to actually go for the idea of the universal requirement to have insurance. Because you remember, during their debates, they debated this, whether there should be a universal requirement. So there were a lot of issues.
The mandate, right?
Which Barack Obama was against,
right,
during the campaign. So you did have a sense, I think, among a lot of liberals, black and white, that once Barack Obama became elected, he kind of became Bill Clinton. He had a lot of Clinton's people, which, of course, is natural because you pick up the staffers from the last Democratic president. But also a lot of people saw it as ostentatious, too many Clinton people. And that the triangulation was creeping in. And liberals really pushed back on that hard. And again, it was successful. If you look at the lame duck session of 2010, it might have been the most successful lame duck session in terms of progressive policy since the 60s. There hasn't been this much legislation pushed through in a single term under Nancy Pelosi since the 1964-65 Congress. So it was successful. The liberal pushback actually worked. And it forced this president to the left on issues. Some liberals won, some they lost. They never did win cram down. They didn't win on the public option. But you did have, on a net basis, progressive policy won the day. But I think for African Americans, the perception, fair or unfair,
right,
was that this pushback that particularly white liberals were giving against the president was unfair and was a different standard than President Clinton had been held to. So fairly or unfairly, it did cause a rift between African Americans and white liberals that I think still persists. And the support that black folk have for the president doesn't stop them from criticizing him. There's a lot of criticism, particularly about his non-racial kind of affect when he's talking about policy. But I think there is also a sense that liberals writ large were unfair to him. That's just a real perception.
Interesting. I mean, and when we talk about within the context of the black community and not necessarily, I don't know, you would probably have a better sense of this than I would in terms of, you know, sort of how much is the sort of the sentiment within the black community mirrored by the sentiment among the sort of the black intellectual community? Because, you know, it seems to me that you have like your Ta-Nehisi Coates who talks about, you know, why is President Obama talking about my brother's keeper, right? I mean, this is that is a very Clinton-esque, the respectability politics, like, you know, in many respects, this is, we're not going to deal with public policy. We're going to deal with, African-Americans need to, exercise sort of some type of higher level of moral responsibility. And then you also have a critique coming from people like Cornel West, who are talking about the implications of what's happening to the black community from, I think, also from an economic standpoint, too, like rolling in those type of things like cram down. And, you know, and it also we also later know, at least from, you know, according to Barney Frank, that there was an opportunity for direct relief for mortgage holders that was on the table as President Obama was president-elect. And he basically said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to sign off on it. It's not up to me, which, of course, you know, everybody in charge was saying at the time, it's up to you. I mean, give me your sense of where that of what that where how that sentiment may be different within the black community.
Well, I mean, I think you named the two people who embody the two sides of that argument. So I think the Ta-Nehisi Coates side of the argument, which is the scolding black people to as a way of addressing their pain, is wrong. And I think that is a broad sentiment among African Americans, particularly black men, who do not, every time the president mentions my brother's keeper, it sounds a discordant note to a lot of African Americans who say, no, it's a non sequitur. If we're talking about police brutality or we're talking about economic deprivation, then pivoting to my brother's keeper is just the wrong answer, particularly on issues like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown.
It's almost opposite of the wrong answer, right? I mean, it's like it's basically Paul Ryan's, you know, I met a kid who would rather have a brown bag sandwich than a free meal from school. I mean, it's
or Ben Carson, who says right. Essentially the same thing, right? So that people really, it's a discordant note when he sounds it, and he stopped doing it, by the way. I think he's finally heard that, and I've been in rooms where he and Ta-Nehisi Coates have addressed this with each other, and neither would back down on whether it was wrong or right to do that. But the president has finally kind of abandoned that, I think, and a lot of black people would say hallelujah that he's kind of walked away from that approach. But when you go to the other side, the Cornel West side, I think Dr. West really discredited himself with most African Americans because of the way he went after the president in a way that just seemed personal and petty and small. And so I think any kind of personal attacks on the president, whether it's from the right or whether it's from the left, are really received poorly by African Americans. An intellectual critique of him that you hear from the Michael Eric Dysons of the world or the Ta-Nehisi Coates of the world or any number of African American men and women writers, that's legitimate. But when you have that sort of personal, nasty critique, calling him the global George Zimmerman, a black mascot of Wall Street, West is completely discredited. So it was ironic that he's the person that a Bernie Sanders would turn to as a validator. He is not. He may be a validator with white liberals, but African Americans, that isn't really the validator you want, right? So, because it's too personal. And I think that African Americans are very personally protective of Barack Obama. The polling and the research shows that there is a great protectiveness of him as a man, because people are so proud that he is there and are so proud of him just in his comportment. But there is an internal critique that African Americans have of him. It isn't personal. You know what I mean? It's about policy. So I think that's the difference.
Well, I mean, I want to push back just a little bit on this. I mean, I'm not quite sure that Coates and Dyson are necessarily offering the same critiques of the president. And I don't know. I mean, we can talk about the tenor of Cornel West's critiques on some level. But do you think that there is nothing to the substance of the critique, that in many ways, I mean, if you look at where Black people have been traditionally in terms of pushing social justice. I mean, for instance, MLK, you know, essentially, I think probably a self-proclaimed socialist, is reinterpreted at the very least by, you know, guys like Reagan and Clinton, and then, you know, I think to a certain extent, you know, perhaps Barack Obama, where the sort of the economic messages and the sort of the more radical messages are sort of stripped out. And on some level, I mean, I think it was Glenn Ford who came on this program back in 2011, I think in the run-up to the 2012, was saying that President Obama managed essentially to, in some way, neutralize that perspective coming from the African American community, which is so important to American politics, because in many respects they have always been on the losing end of the economic formulas, right? Even the New Deal, which ostensibly is to give you know, Americans a new chance. Very, like you've said, explicitly and implicitly in many respects, left African Americans behind. Was that voice, that part about that talking about economic justice, and we're, you know, black unemployment is at is still significantly almost double that of white unemployment. Doesn't that in some way have some resonance? I mean, or is it simply it is just. Is there a sense that you cannot critique the president on those terms?
No, I think that you certainly can, and people have, lots of people have critiqued him and still retained their credibility with African Americans. I think when you get to the kind of personal vituperativeness of a Cornel West, it cancels out whatever the rest of that message is. And I think that was where he hurt himself, quite frankly, with African Americans, was that the critique felt too personal. I think you can say the same of Tavis Smiley, that African Americans by and large rejected the tenor of their remarks.
Well, that's fine. But okay, let's talk about the substance, though. I mean, yeah. Do you think there's a validity to the substance of the critique aside from the tenor? I mean, I think, you know, it's certainly arguable that the tenor is, you know, should have been more measured or used different words.
Well, in the case of West, the tenor is the substance, right? Either the president is a black mascot of Wall Street or he's not, right? And I think that it's such a pejorative, it's not really anything you can even legitimately debate. I think if you go to some of the critiques that you have a Michael Eric Dyson make, and he has a book coming out, it's, you know, pretty critical of the president. I think there is a lot to it, but I think you have to remember that, as you know, my friend and colleague Reverend Al Sharpton says, the president cannot march on himself. He is not a civil rights leader. And I think a lot of the critique that ties him to King is a false critique. It's the mistake that Hillary Clinton made in 2008. Barack Obama was not running to be Martin Luther King Jr. He was running to be Lyndon Johnson. And so I think that the idea is that if King were alive today, the person he'd be marching on would be Barack Obama. Right, Barack Obama is not King and is not in the business of restorative justice. He's not a civil rights leader. He's a president of the United States. He's a politician. And so politicians, and he'll say this and has said this, require, if they are honest politicians, they require the critique to come to them, and then they are required to respond. They are not the critiquers of their own of themselves. So I think on a social justice standpoint, we need a social justice movement, and you need politicians. They're two different lanes. And so you count on
But I feel like we're talking at cross purposes here, because, all right, look, I don't think it's appropriate to say that somebody's a black mascot of anything. But the argument, it seems to me that the substance, I mean, if you get past that, if someone was, if Cornel West had said that Barack Obama is Wall Street's man in our government, that seems to be a very hard argument to argue against. All right, and here's a couple of pieces I think just sort of, you know, evidence that would suggest that. One, his attorney general refused doctrinally to prosecute bankers. Two, this is a guy who wanted to put Robert Rubin in his as a cabinet at one point until a scandal basically took him out. He didn't choose to bail out homeowners directly, but rather has been funding, you know, went to fund the banks. He wouldn't get involved in the cram down. When they started this whole mortgage, mortgage committee in the run up to the 2012 election, that thing completely just sort of melted away. I mean, so the critique is not about social justice, it seems to me. It is about, here's a guy who is working for the some of the worst parts of the establishment power base. And I think it's a critique that people level at Hillary Clinton, too, on some level. And she's working to get away from it. I mean, that part of the critique. And then ultimately on a sort of like a derivative of that is that when you support when Wall Street wins, the first people who lose tend to be African Americans because of things like going as far back as things like redlining, right? And so, I mean, is there no substance to that critique? I mean, where else is that being made within the context of the black community?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it would. I think the White House would be find it ironic to have Barack Obama be called Wall Street's man in Washington, because Wall Street spent inordinate sums of money and seem to be willing to spend unlimited sums of money to get rid of him and to rid themselves of him. So I don't think Wall Street agrees with that. And I think you have to also remember, too, that the Democratic Party and the folks that are there, not just the president, but also the Congress, crafted what they believed was the appropriate response to what Wall Street did to the country. And I would probably agree with you and argue that what they crafted was a lot less onerous and a lot less punitive than what you or I would have crafted based on what Wall Street had done and the breadth and the extent of their profligacy, quite frankly. One could argue that across the board, Democrats in Washington decided to stand down when it came to the response and try to heal. They, you know, Democrats in general, I think constitutionally, small street C constitutionally, are always about solutions to problems that hold the country together. And I think you did have, not just on this, look, think about the fact that on national security, the Democratic Congress, this is Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, were in charge in 2006 when Eric Lichtblau and James Risen discovered, because they were the first ones, they and Kurt Eichenwald, to discover the warrantless wiretapping program, right? Eichenwald wrote about it in 05, Lichtblau and Risen write about it in 06, even though Snowden gets the credit for it, they wrote about it first. And this, at the time, was with no warrants. The response of the Democratic-run Congress, and at that time, Barack Obama was actually a United States senator, the response was not to shut that down. It was to codify it into law, right? To actually write it into law. And so what you had also was Democrats, when the president was elected, make a decision altogether. Not the White House as some sort of monarchy make the decision, but the Democrats broadly made the decision to do the bill they did. Which was their response to the Wall Street crash. Now, do you lay that all at the feet of the White House, or do you say that Democrats in general are politicians? They're politicians who are accommodationist in general versus the way their base would like them to be. They're more accommodationist than you'd like. Now, does that make any of them mascots of Wall Street? No. Does it make any of them Wall Street's man or woman? No. I think it makes them politicians.
Well, I mean, some. I mean, you know, I mean,
very few who opposed it. I mean, Democrats, remember, Democrats voted unanimously to prevent the executive order to shut Gitmo. Remember, that was Democrats that participated in that. Democrats, almost to a man,
yes,
with the exception of four of them, voted no. We will not allow Guantanamo to be closed. Now, liberals laid that at the feet of the White House and still do.
Yes, and I think that is, I mean, I think in the context of Guantanamo, I mean, I think part of it is because, you know, the president was the one who made that vow, and I think that was probably not smart politics, you know, but nevertheless, that doesn't, I mean, I don't know. I have a different sense of just how many sort of unilateral things that the president could have done in terms of Wall Street. And it's true. Maybe Wall Street is very unappreciative people. And
were willing to spend any sum of money to rid themselves of this person.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like,
and I think, that very well may be the case. And they complain that it's like Nazi Germany around here. I mean, literally, we've had Wall Streeters who said, like, this is like 1933, and we're like the new incantation of Jews. Nevertheless, when you look at things like HARP and you look at an attorney general and his number two who come out and say, we literally have a policy of not going after these people criminally because we do not believe that it's in the best interest of the economic system to do so. That's problematic, right?
I interviewed Eric Holder not long ago, and I asked him about that, about the prosecution aspect, and he did not in any way say what you just said, that they had a policy that was bad for the country. And this is obviously his take, but what the former attorney general said is that they looked at what had happened on Wall Street and looked to see if there were any prosecutable cases, and that they just couldn't find anything that they could actually prosecute. That while these were immoral, while we may have had attitudes that the people on Wall Street who did what they did were amoral even, that they didn't have prosecutable cases. That's the case they would make. I haven't heard the attorney general say as a policy matter they decided they wouldn't prosecute people.
In 2014 or 2013, Eric Holder said that I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions become so large that it does become difficult for to prosecute them when we're hit with indications. If we do bring criminal charges, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And he said, I think it has an inhibiting influence, impact on our ability to bring resolutions that I think would be more appropriate. In other words, he's saying that we have made a policy decision that if we were to prosecute these banks, individuals, it could have a broader negative impact, and we're not going to do it. Now, I think he probably backed off that after maybe it was in March that he said this. And certainly Lanny Brewer said it in that PBS documentary, which ended up, was it Lanny Brewer or number two, I think was his name. I mean, he ended up going. But we can litigate this back and forth on some level. I think that's where... That's what, sort of interests me, is that there does seem to be multiple different fracture lines in the context of both the African-American community as it relates to Obama and the Democratic Party. That was the point of the book.
It's true. And it's interesting because it's still playing out. And I think those fault lines within the Democratic Party, they're real. They tend not to be as detrimental or as overt as the Republican fault lines are, because theirs are just far more ratchet, and so we pay more attention to them. But they are there, and I think you'll see in the Bernie Sanders race a little more of that play out. Ultimately, what happens, I think the demographics are lend themselves to Hillary Clinton, but we'll see. We'll see if liberals can overcome and vanquish the establishment in this primary.
Yeah,
hard for them to do. You never know.
It's going to be a fascinating race, and of course, tomorrow night is the second Democratic Forum, and I imagine we'll hear at least some of these things come up in that context. Joy Reid, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. We will put a link to Fracture on our page. Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide. We'll put it on at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sam, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. Went a little long. But this topic I find is really... fascinating. And it's interesting to me to see sort of like the different perspectives on this, particularly in the Black community on this issue and this relationship with Barack Obama. And as Bernie Sanders said today, he needs to make greater inroads into the African-American community. And of course, at the very least, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if what we're seeing is, I mean, yes, on Twitter, And in some circles, the reaction of Bernie Sanders supporters to Black Lives Matter was not particularly good, in my opinion. And we talked about that at the time. I'm not sure really how much the really just life outside of Twitter was really aware of this. I don't know that people in the Black community or your average, you know, even liberal is walking around going like, I'm still, you know, all shook up from what happened on Twitter after the Black Lives Matter thing.
I hope nobody is saying that they're all shook up from something. Well, no,
but I think people who engage in that and see it on a regular basis probably feel the impact. But I would be really shocked if, broadly speaking, there was even an awareness of that. Of at least the reaction by Bernie Sanders supporters. And so I think what is a far more important dynamic that's playing out with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton is the African-American community has been aware and knows Hillary Clinton for 30 years. And Bernie Sanders has been only sort of the awareness of him has really only been in more sort of liberal, you know, Vermontish circles.
I mean, I think, and I also think, obviously, just even watching him campaign, he's learning to speak to more constituencies and different constituencies. And his first response to Black Lives Matter wasn't good. But I think what sort of frustrated me is I can think of several politicians who maybe just culturally, through their interests, through their reading, whether it's Bill Clinton or Bill Bradley or Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, who have maybe a better sense of those issues in some ways or more ease in talking about those issues than Bernie Sanders. But just on a policy level, for all of his flaws, it just seems so clear that he would have the best benefit in the African-American community, in the Hispanic community. And I think that there's a really big irony in that conversation coming out of Obama, the Obama era specifically, in some ways, of some type of almost corporate Democrat with African-American and Hispanic Democrat alliance in the context of a Democratic primary, almost sort of skipping over the policy implications. And I think it's, you know, how much does it matter at a certain point that someone has an ease and familiarity with a topic versus an actual policy agenda? I mean, Bill Clinton's the ultimate example.
The reality is that I think most people in all contexts, the way that they are convinced by an individual is you get a sense. Does this person understand what it is to be me? Because most people don't understand what the cram down fight was about.
Right.
Most normal people, and I'm not saying this disparagingly. I'm saying, like, you know, most normal people, I don't know, maybe normal is a little bit extreme, but most people, they don't have time to look in the intricacies of the cram down. Most people don't have time to sort of like find out what exactly Barney Frank was saying that Hank Paulson said to him at that time. I think rather what people do, and it's a perfectly rational response in my mind, is like I meet Jim or I meet Mary and I say, do they sort of get a sense of who I am and what it's like to be me? And then I say they do. And then I trust that they're going to sort of do stuff that's going to benefit me, that it's going to be in my interest in some respects. And so, you know, that's what it comes down to. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Folks, the number is 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of this program. You can also IM me via our app or I guess any IM client that you would like. Folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We can't do it without you. Literally. I mean, we could do it without you because we could just be one of those days where, like, we just don't even check the stats and we just put the show out and it would be we just do the show and no one hears it. But we can't do it without your support. So even if you decide never to listen to the program again, it's your support that really makes it possible for us to put it out for you not to listen to. You can't really not listen to the program unless we're putting it out. So even if you want to not listen to the program, you need to support the show, because if you try and not listen to the program and the show doesn't exist, you're not really not listening to the program. You're just going about your life. So for you to stop listening to the show, you need to support it. And of course, if you're listening to the show, why wouldn't you support it? So there
also
you have
a review.
Oh, yeah. You could leave us a review on iTunes if you wanted to do. I mean, we have many people who are unable to afford the bonus show that we give, but they're really interested in it. And so we work out a deal with them, and they go and they'll put a review on iTunes for us, or they'll spread the word in some other way. Or if they buy crap from Amazon, they'll buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Every time you go, you click on that link, your Amazon experience is exactly the same as it was if you go there directly. But if you go through our link, we get a kickback, thus majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. 646-257-3920. Say it and I will pay.